Hello and welcome to PaleoCast. In this two-part episode, I want to say happy birthday! And if it happens to be your birthday, well, that's a wonderful coincidence and many congratulations to you. But I'm actually sending my congratulations to a very specific recipient, the Paleontographical Society. The society is 175 years old, making it the oldest society dedicated to paleontology in the world. Coincidentally, 2022 is also the 200th anniversary of the coining of the word paleontology itself. It was first used by the zoologist and anatomist Henri de Blainville in 1822, and my apologies to our French-speaking listeners for butchering that pronunciation. So this year is a really special one for the history of paleontology. But you might be asking yourself, who are the Paleontographical Society? Well, you're not the only one. It was when I was a student of paleontology that I first came across them. And my main interest initially was simply to apply for their Richard Owen Research Fund. And this provides small financial grants to support paleontological research. I was successful and I attended their annual general meeting to collect the grant. And that was my first taste of the Paleontographical Society, or PALSOC for short. I'm proud to say that almost a decade later, I've now stepped into the role of secretary of the society, and I'm only the second woman to do so in their 175-year history. Now, despite their vintage, this prestigious organisation is much less well-known than other learned societies, let alone those that focus on extinct life. This is despite the fact that over its long history, some of the most famous names in paleontology were members and presidents. Richard Owen, Charles Darwin, Henry de la Beche, Charles Lyell, Gideon Mantell, Roderick Murchison, Adam Sedgwick, the list goes on. The Society's original purpose was to publish exquisite monographs on fossils, and these publications continue and they underpin the detailed anatomical and systematic study of fossil groups in the British Isles. But it turns out that PALSOC has a much greater role to play in the history of paleontology more generally than previously recognised, and it's set to continue this legacy in the coming decades. In these two episodes, I'll speak to two guests who will help me uncover PALSOC's unique history and exciting future. In part one, I'll be chatting with Victor Monin. He's a historian of science who specialises in the history of paleontology, particularly the place of the visual arts and the history of paleo art. He elaborates on PALSOC's vital part in the history of visual representations of fossils and the wider context of figuring specimens in the 19th century. In part two, I'll be speaking to Dr. Caroline Butler from National Museum of Wales, who's the first female president of PALSOC, and she'll tell me more about what PALSOC do, and we'll discuss diversity in paleontology and how this historic organisation are changing to meet the demands of paleontologists today and into the future. So, without further ado, let's meet my first guest and find out more about PALSOC's really interesting 175-year history. Okay, so could I ask you to introduce yourself?
Of course. Well, thank you so much first, Elsa, for inviting me. My name is Victor Monin, and I recently defended my dissertation, Epistemology and History of Science, from the University of Strasbourg. I'm currently an associate member at the Archive Henri Poincaré, or the Poincaré, the Henri Poincaré Archives, which are both located at the University of Strasbourg and the University of Nancy in France. And I am particularly interested in the history of paleontology as it relates to the history of colonialism in particular, the history of nation building processes as well. So mostly focusing on the 19th century. And as I was conducting my research, my doctoral research, I became increasingly interested in the use of the visual arts, the place that the visual arts holds in the history of paleontology. And obviously that led me to looking at a lot of things related to paleo art. And obviously that also led me to being interested in the paleontographical society and all sorts of visual endeavors that were conducted in the 19th century, whether it be in Europe or the United States. And I think when it comes to that particular topic, the Paleontographical Society and its history are absolutely central to look into.
So, well, welcome so much to PaleoCast. We're really delighted to have you here. I suppose a little bit of history as to why I'm speaking to you and why I've invited you is also because we ended up, I can't remember what we were speaking about previously, and we ended up chatting about the Paleontographical Society. And I was really delighted and quite surprised that you had heard about it and that you were excited and interested in the society, because it was founded in 1847, so it's celebrating its 175th year. But generally, it's a little bit overlooked, really, when it comes to the history of learned societies, of scientific societies, which is, of course, one of the things that really interests me. But I'd like to know, I guess, first of all, what it is about the Paleontographical Society that interests you. You said that it links to your research because you're interested in visual things. So how are the two things related?
Yes. So if I can do a little bit again of you know, how I came to learn about the Paleontographical Society, and you're absolutely right. What's interesting is that it's completely overlooked. And when I really began my research on the visual arts and paleontology, I was obviously doing a lot of reading, and I was coming across a lot of great a lot of great research, especially on the drawings by Georges Cuvier, for example, the drawings by Henri de la Beche, all sorts of great arts that were being done at the beginning of the 19th century. I can't honestly remember how I first heard of the Paleontographical Society. It might have been doing some all sorts of cross-referencing. And I found this society. And I was then absolutely shocked to find almost no reference about that society in all the scholarship I was reading. About the visual arts in paleontology, or just about paleontology, geology in general at the time. It might have been mentioned here and there, and maybe this is how I've heard of it, but no actual commentary on it. And, well, one way to just easily connect the visual arts and the Paleontographical Society, and why, when I found out about it, I got immediately incredibly interested, is simply the name itself. Paleontographical Society.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it?
It's a complete mouthful. That's exactly what I was going to say, especially for a French person. So, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right even to this day. But it was the graphical that really struck with me, because I can't think about another society in earth sciences at the time, and even maybe today, that instead of going for the logy, geology, paleontology, right, would go for the graphical. And what's extremely interesting about that is that it says a lot, or at least gives us a very interesting clue to understand at the time in 1847 and a little bit prior, when the society was being, you know, it was an idea in progress, what was the main intention, the main motivation behind it. And I think we can just think about it in terms of just etymology, right? If they had went for paleontology or paleontological society, well, here, the word logos, right, would have been the important foundation. Logos in Greek, obviously the idea of the theory, the knowledge, right? Basically creating, producing claims, knowledge claims about paleontology. But here, the focus was not so much on theory, it was on graphis, right? Mm-hmm. So design, description, anything mm-hmm. related to how can we communicate, duplicate the fossils that we find, and in a manner that maybe later on will help the logos, the theoretical mm-hmm. work. So I think, to me, this is what's struck me at first, and maybe that's because of my background in art history, that I was immediately drawn to this idea of the graphic and input and that presence of the graphic in the name itself.
Yeah, I've always found that extremely interesting because obviously it was formed initially to further to be an output for monographs, for basically the visualization of specimens, which up to that point, I believe, were scattered between multiple publications. And, you know, it was sort of basically that some of the greatest minds in paleontology at the time got together and said, you know, we really need to create something that is specifically for us to figure our specimens. And of course, it's grown beyond that original remit. But I think it's really interesting that visualization was its sort of key role to begin with. I wonder, what role did that sort of visualization of fossils then go on to play in the history of science and wider society?
So I think in order to really understand the impact of such a society and the need in the first place to create such a society, you have to take just a step back and look at the beginning of the 19th century, where the theoretical and the methodological foundation of paleontology are set in place, right? Hmm. From the geological perspective, with paleontological stratigraphy, as you know, developed by William Smith in particular, but of course many other actors. And on the other end, not so much the applied paleontology, but paleontology as a branch of biology would be the work by Georges Cuvier, for example, and the use of comparative anatomy, etc. And after, you know, and so that's around the really early 1800s, 1810s. And right after that, it created an absolute fascination for just the rational ability to recreate these worlds, right? Mm-hmm. And it created all sorts of projects and incentives to produce a great number of publications all across Europe, all across the United States as well. It prompted numerous voyages and explorations, etc. And so that was absolutely formidable, right? But the problem is, and something that the founders of the society are realizing in 1840, is that there are so much information now available that we are, first of all, not really able to track its evolution. Where is the reliable information stored? Mm. And there was also the sense that the method through which the information was being produced and conveyed was not homogeneous enough. So paleontology at the time was basically victim of its success. I would say it in this way, because okay. There's so many great contributions that were made, but as you mentioned, they were scattered everywhere. Hmm. And maybe if you want, I can talk about how the society at this time compared to other enterprises that were done, which I think reveals a lot about the motivation of the society itself, and then how all of that impacted the field of paleontology later on.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. Go on.
So yeah, we could look at it. So right there is this context that we talked about, and actually what we see, and what I was very interested in once I found about the Paleontological Society, I was looking into, well, okay, this happens in Great Britain, but is there something else? Are there other enterprises of the same sort happening anywhere else in Europe or anywhere else in the United States? And what's incredibly interesting is that, yes, there is a moment, and the 1840s are really a moment where the paleontological community recognizes that very problem of scattered information and maybe also unreliable information because of the lack of conventions in regard to the representation of fossils, their visual representation, but also their written description. And actually in 1840, Alcide d'Orbigny, the French paleontologist, one of the founders of micropaleontology, actually starts a whole project called the Paléontologie Française, or French paleontology, where his goal is basically the same goal that will be the goal of the society in 1847, but for France. And the idea is, first of all, he's extremely concerned by just that, the scattering of information and the lack of standardized rules on how to represent and describe fossils. And it's a real problem, because the idea is that if we continue on without creating these standards, without forging these standards of representation, then we might actually make it even harder for us later on to continue build a sustainable science, right? So you went on this quest of touring France in its entirety, and just collaborating with all sorts of private collectors, other scientists, people just simply interested. He talks of how happy he is to find such open-minded, scientific-oriented French citizens. So there's also a lot about, you know, building a sense of, you know, nation pride, I'll say. But what's extremely interesting is that he publishes, over the course of 20 years, something like 30 volumes, illustrated volumes, with descriptions, extremely detailed descriptions that follow all the same patterns, and also his illustrations are, I would say, he pays a lot of attention of how many specimens should be on each page, what should be the different angles represented, and all these standards are then being used for every single volume.
And is this something that was then adopted in other countries as well? Did he set the standards really for the whole science, or was this confined to France?
So I don't want to be biased, right?
We're all biased.
I will say that my bias simply comes from the fact that I rely a lot, obviously, on French sources, and that's simply because of, you know, a language barrier. So maybe it happened earlier somewhere else, and actually, Alcide d'Orbigny, in his preface to this massive work, refers to the work of Murchison, refers to the work of other scientists from Europe, saying that they basically started what he intends to do, but not in as much of a systematic way than he wants to do it. But he sees, for example, the Silurian fossils by Murchison as an example of what should be done, right? So there are, you know, he recognizes a lot of prior contributions, but What's interesting is that then the work of d'Aubigny is actually quoted everywhere. If you look at the publications throughout the 19th century, you will see in every references then that paleontologists are when they're cross-referencing, you will see the name of d'Aubigny pretty much everywhere.
Because going back to what you said there about language and language barriers, I suppose the kind of people, predominantly men, who were engaged in these sciences at the time wouldn't have had those barriers, because most of them could speak at least two languages, if not more. And so they were well versed in the literature in particularly France and Germany, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And those are the works he mostly referred to. And French at the time was still very much an international language and a language of science. Mm. So English was not as dominant as it is today in the field of research. So there's definitely an argument here also to think about how influential the work of Alcide d'Aubigny might have been. And since it was published, began to be published in 1840. And by 1847, actually, he's publishing is already his fourth or third volume of illustration and written description. So there's definitely an argument here for the influence of Alcide d'Aubigny's work on then the philosophy and the motivation behind the Paleontographical Society. And you can actually mention another project in 1840, which also began to be published in 1847, but this time in the United States by the paleontologist and geologist James Hall, who was at first in the 1840s one of the many scientists involved in the groundbreaking geological survey of New York State, one of the first real massive program, public funded program dedicated to the geology of a particular state. And at, when this committee, this group of scientists reached their conclusion, I'll say, so around the late 1830s and 1840s, they realized that they were lacking a clear understanding and also clear references to the fossil fauna and flora of New York. And this is where the idea in the 1840s of the paleontology of New York in the mind of James Hall and his colleagues started to arise. And in 1847, he's publishing the first volume of that Paleontology of New York. And this is a massive individual work, just like the one of Alcide d'Aubigny, which will end with his death around the 1890s, if I'm not mistaken. And it includes thousands of illustrations.
Mm. This is really interesting. So it sounds like the Paleontographical Society is, of course, as I said, like the oldest dedicated society to paleontology. But it sounds like it really has, it was formed as part of a zeitgeist, really, that was occurring, but also that it has perhaps a really important role in the history of scientific illustration and art then. I mean, it really ought to be better known.
Absolutely. I would say that, ironically enough, the Paleontographical Society came a little late in the game.
Late to the party.
Yeah, if you think about it, right? Because Alcide d'Aubigny is basically begins to publish his French paleontology in 1840. By 1847, James Hall in New York is already publishing his first volume, which is already a massive accomplishment. So it comes slightly late in the game. And also, I could mention there's actually a very interesting paper that's been published about the Paleontologica Polska in Poland, which was published in 1847 and was actually very much inspired by Alcide d'Aubigny as well. So yeah, a little late in the game, but to the credit of the Paleontographical Society, and I think that's what also makes it very particular in peculiar in the history of science and geology and paleontology, is that it has endured.
Yes.
It remains. It is still an activity today, which is not something we can say about the French paleontology by Alcide d'Orbigny, although his project stopped with his death and was then picked up by other geologists and paleontologists. And I think the last volumes were published around the mid 20th century, but it never took the form of an actual society or institution that could carry on the work. And the same can be said about James Hall. It was very much something centered around the figure of James Hall, although there was, of course, a lot of people involved in the process. And I can't say about the example in Poland. I can't say much more. But this is what is interesting about the Paleontographical Society, is that it's a society that is centered around the idea that the illustration of fossil and its precise descriptions are essential to the work of paleontologists. And I think that's obviously what makes it so intriguing, is because I can't think of another example of a scientific institution specifically dedicated to that. Mm. And this is what makes it even more, I don't want to, because I'm frustrated about this, because so I don't want to use a bad word, but I'll say that I'm, you know, very intrigued by how it has been almost ignored by the historiography so far. Because I can't think of another example.
That's really interesting. And I suppose the difference, and perhaps part of what sets it apart and has allowed it to endure, is it sounds like many of those other instances you're describing are sort of, they revolve around one person or one particular place and the visualization of those specimens. Whereas the society, it seems almost like they realized that they also needed to put money back into the research, because of course they fund research as well. And so it's ended up becoming something that is almost self-sustaining by help assisting people to carry out the research. They therefore use the monograph series and it kind of continues cyclically like that. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah, I'll say, yes, there is definitely a very interesting reflection on how can we not only solve the problem of the scattered, unstandardized information that exists about fossils, but also produce information about the fossil record on a sustainable basis.
Mm.
And I think what's interesting is that there's this idea of sustainability, because if you look at, I don't know if it's still true about the volume that are published today, but if you look at the first volumes within the first 20, 30 years of the Paleontographical Society, what's extremely interesting is that at the opening of every single volume, there is a synoptic table that draws the summary of which fossil group have been represented in which volume. So you basically have this table made of blanks and dots that, very much like a stratigraphical table. It's very interesting. But where they track their own publication.
Yeah.
So there really is this fascinating idea, because if you think about it as a stratigraphical table, they were very much thinking about each volume should represent an aspect of the actual fossil record that exists within the Earth. So this is where the graphical is so fascinating, because the work of the Paleontographical Society is to create, to achieve a perfect image of the fossil record that exists, right? So to duplicate it, and and therefore to make the research on paleontology so much easier. So because they were tracking their own advancement, there was also a sense that, well, it's going to take time. That's going to take some time. Although they were very ambitious at the early stage, I think they were estimating to be for the work of the Paleontographical Society to be complete in 20 years. it is, which obviously is not the case. It is still a long time. They were still, you know, they were still obviously thinking about how can we at least sustain for 20 years? How can we at least continue that work for 20 years? And if needed more. So I think that that's what makes it absolutely interesting also in not only for the history of paleontological and geological sciences, but also in the history of societies and their role in general in shaping the kind of business model that support science.
Mm. And it's interesting that, the first monograph was on the crag mollusks, but I mean, subsequently, some of the biggest names in the history of paleontology published monographs, and also some of the sort of classic images we have of, you know, in air quotes, the Victorian fossils. People don't realize they actually are plates from Paleontographical Society monographs. I mean, a couple of examples, real classic examples, are Darwin's papers on barnacles, and also Richard Owen's papers, for example, on the dinosaurs of Wealden or the mammals of the Lias. And when you actually go through them, you suddenly think, hang on, I've seen these images before. They've endured as, I mean, yes, historical images, but so beautifully created that they still have value for researchers as well as for the public as something recognizable in the history of science. I wanted to come back to the role of illustration and you know, I slightly changed subject a little bit, because one of the other things we talked about is that if you look up Paleontographical Society and start combing through the images, other than images of the actual monographs themselves, there's very little else that comes up. But one thing that does come up is this very curious picture of a meal that took place at the Paleontographical Society. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about this image, what it is and what it shows?
Yes, so among the, as you mentioned, the very rare sources we can find on the Paleontographical Society, or at least archives that are directly available online, is this, yes, very uncanny, strange illustration that I believe was the cover for the menu of a dinner organized in 1872. For the Paleontographical Society. So first of all, that kind of indicates something interesting about how this society was ran. It seems like it was both a society that was obviously scientific, but it was also these kinds of societies, social gathering societies, that would have annual or regular dinners, and their members could simply socialize. So that's also kind of raises the question about what kind of society was the Paleontographical Society? There are very different kinds of models to understand these societies historically. So that's maybe a question also it raises. But to go back to that illustration is actually a cartoon or a caricature of various members of the Paleontographical Society just sitting at a fancy dinner table, around a fancy dinner table. And the very interesting thing about this image is that all the people attending that dinner are actually portrayed as extinct animals.
Except one. I think at the head of the table, is it Richard Owen at the head of the table?
Yes, except for one. Richard Owen, who is portrayed, right, or caricatured, but still as himself, actually cutting into a dodo.
Yep, he's about to carve up the dodo.
About to carve up the dodo insert. So, I mean, there's all sorts of minute detail, which I think we're all punts. Right, were all jokes intended at the people who were invited in the first place, so the members of the Paleontographical Society in the first place. So this would be absolutely fantastic to decode and look at all the various jokes that are being made or references that are being made. There's actually a very small detail where you can see on the side of the table. It's at the foreground of the image. There's a little note that says, which on it is written, "Save the bones for Dr. Owen." but it's so interesting because maybe it says something.
Oh, I see it there. Yeah, it says, "Do not eat your bones, but save them for Professor Owen." Yeah.
Yes.
It's so tiny, it's almost unreadable. It's amazing. We'll place this image in the description of the episode so people can have a look. But for those who maybe won't see that, it's worth describing a little bit more, I mean, just about what's going on, because it's such a fantastic image. I mean, yes, we've got eight guests and Richard Owen. And in the centerpiece, there's things like there's a cycad, which at first I thought was a pineapple, but it's a cycad. There's ammonites on some of the plates for eating. And then people are things like Dimorphodon. There's a saber-toothed cat. There's I think that's meant to be Platybelodon, which is like an extinct elephant. It's kind of difficult to tell what a couple of them are meant to be. And then I think there's a strange looking sort of waiter standing in the background that is something I don't recognize, some kind of invertebrate. Maybe somebody could comment in the comments on our page if they recognize what it is. And they're all just tucking in and they've got their little spectacles on. And their tailcoats, and there's a top hat sitting at the side. It's just a fabulous image, isn't it?
It is, and it makes you wonder if this was a tradition and if this kind of caricature actually, if there are more of them. Because when you think about the first president of the society, right? And I hope I'm pronouncing it right, because Henri de la Beche, right? He was himself a very good artist and very much interested in the visual arts and its use for the teaching of geology and paleontology. We owe him one of the first paleo art piece, actually. He was also very much, he was indulging a lot in caricature. Indulging a lot in caricature to, in his own notebooks, he would draw all sorts of caricature. And actually the historian Martin Rudwick has commented on some of them where de la Beche would use these caricature to articulate his own criticism, his own thoughts on theories or observation he would oppose. And especially he drew a series of caricature on Charles Dalle and his principles of geology. So there is a very interesting, also here we're talking about illustration, but it's the Paleontographical Society, based on just this little cartoon from 1872. The Paleontographical Society is very much at the intersection of a very diverse branches of the visual culture of the Victorian time, but also of the Victorian science in general. And that includes paleontological illustration, scientific illustration, but also cartoons, caricatures, paleo art. So all sorts of branches of the visual arts.
So this is cutting edge, basically, in its day. This is what people are doing. This is the equivalent, isn't it, of tweeting and social media now in paleontology, except that back then it's caricatures and dinner invitations.
So I don't know what kind of impact these images would have, right? What would be the audience? For example, when it comes to, I don't want to say anything incorrect, but when it comes to the caricatures of Charles Liel by Henri de Labèche, I think they were very much private, things that he would keep for himself. He would basically doodle these things to maybe, you know, as a visual thinker, you know, get his ideas and arguments straight and maybe, you know, just show it to a couple of friends. But I want to go back to your remark on, like, this is cutting edge. I think in many ways, one way to understand the past, and as a paleontologist, you know that better than me, is to look at the present. Mm-hmm. And we could draw maybe some sort of an interesting analogy, or at least compare what was happening with the Paleontographical Society and all these other endeavors that I mentioned, by James Hall, Alcide d'Aubigny. We could compare it to what is going on with virtual paleontology, virtual fossils nowadays. Mm.
You mean like the product of CT scan and visualization and the use of things like Blender and animation softwares and stuff?
Yeah, basically. Okay. Using all the technological resources and trying to, in a way, recast the fossil record, right? Recast the fossil record in a way that would advance the science itself. I think that was one of the main problem that they were facing at the time, and that they were hoping to solve with the Paleontographical Society and the publication, the periodical publication of monographs, set monographs on a particular topic. And if I could add something, is that it's not so much about the images, because the images, scientists have been making images for a long time, right? Mm. So in itself, making images of fossil is not revolutionary. Right. What really changes the game when it comes to the Paleontographical Society and some of the analogous endeavors that are being made at the same time is the fact that these are mapped images. And I'm putting this in quotation, because mapped images is a concept that was proposed by an artist in visual studies, Edward Tufte. And the idea of mapped images is basically the idea that you have the image of a natural object, but this image is also cross-referenced with other images, is cross-referenced with a series of descriptions, is cross-referenced with a series of graphs, of other materials that allow the reader to read the image, but also to trace the source of the image. What is the image actually depicting? Where is the specimen that it's depicting? Where are the analogous specimens that I could use to compare it with? Basically, what changes the game with the Paleontographical Society is just that, establishing the rules for traceability of these images, and therefore really creating what we call the fossil record, making fossils into records, which is not the case when they come out of the ground, obviously, right? They're not records already, or just in a metaphorical sense, but they become records once they're being cross-referenced. And I think this was so interesting about these volumes is because they include not only the images, but all sorts of, obviously, descriptions, and then diagrams, and then also synoptic tables of their location in the stratigraphy in general, and then synoptic tables on where what is the place that this specific monograph is holding in comparison to all the other monographs that have been published.
So almost as well as a mapped image, as you called it, it's also like each monograph itself is mapped within the network of the monograph series and the context of the fossil record in that it describes.
Absolutely.
Wow, it's quite a conceptual thing. So in terms of these illustrations, one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is the sort of hidden histories contained within not just the Paleontographical Society, but in general. And quite often, different societies like the Geology Society and other societies that are still extant today sort of appropriate the figures of history, don't they, and sort of lay claim to them, even though perhaps at the time those people weren't really particularly welcome among their ranks. And I think this happens a lot with the sort of great women of science, that now we recognise their contribution, but of course at the time they were quite often hidden behind what was sort of the outward face of these societies. So in terms of the illustration, many of the illustrations were, of course, created by women, weren't they? There was quite a large contribution of women to creating those images. But in this image we were just talking about, this caricature, you pointed out something really interesting to me about one of the people around the table, one of the animal-headed people. Could you tell me again a bit more about what you were observing here?
Yes, absolutely. So in this caricature covering the menu for the 1872 dinner at the Paleontographical Society, we can attempt at identifying the guests around that table by associating them with the animal they're supposedly discovered or the ones that they're famous for having recreated. And there is one peculiar character, the only, which we could assume, the only female character in that drawing, because it appears it's wearing a dress. It's actually a plesiosaur, right? And I'm speaking here under your but it looks like a plesiosaur, at least the image that at the time you could see published in many, in many publications for the larger audience. And we know that one of the first, if not the first collector to have found fossil of the plesiosaur was Mary Anning. And obviously Mary Anning is maybe one of the most famous women in the history of paleontology and geology. I think she's been recently also celebrated, right? They just inaugurated her statue.
That's right. Yes, in Lyme Regis. Really, yes, beautiful statue.
Yes. But what's interesting, though, is that she, like all of the women at the time, especially in the early days of the Paleontographical Society, she was never a member of the society.
No.
And she dies in 1851, if I'm correct. So she wouldn't have had much opportunities to even join the society. And so that's the case of other women, obviously, who were basically acting as illustrators or collectors behind the scene for their husbands or for their fathers or brothers. And so what's very interesting is that this illustration on the invitation for the Paleontographical Society is including a fictional member of the society, and a member that is obviously a woman. And that everybody knows that there aren't supposed to be any women in that society, right? The rules are set in such a way that there can't be officially any women part of the society. So it's very much an interesting paradox. The kind of contradiction you see when you study history is, at the same time that the rules were set for no women to enter officially the paleontographical society, Mary Anning was actually portrayed on the menu, on the invitation for the celebratory dinner of the society. And that echoes some similar histories that happened in various intellectual scientific societies of the time. I can think of the Geographical Society in London, who tried to take credit or at least include the work of William Smith and his stratigraphical method and mapping technique. They tried to include it in the history and the legacy of the Geological Society, when in fact William Smith was not recognized as part of the gentleman club that the Geological Society was in large part.
It is interesting to ponder if this definitely is Mary Anning, because one thing I would add to what you said there is that the Paleontographical Society did allow actually women members from the beginning, but they weren't council members. They were ordinary members. And I suspect this image would be most likely to represent the council rather than ordinary members. And it would be fascinating to hear from anyone who might have any other suggestions of who else it could be, because it certainly makes sense what you're saying here, that this, of all the people, I mean, who else would we associate close to this time period with marine reptile discoveries? I mean, I can't think of another name. I guess perhaps the Philpotts. I've forgotten her first name now, who's befriended Mary Anning. She was a member of the Paleontographical Society, but she wasn't a council member. So I suppose there's a possibility of that. But it's really fascinating to see her included, whoever she is.
Yeah, whoever that is that person is, if it's not Mary Anning, it's even more fascinating, I would say, because we already know about the legacy of Mary Anning. We also know that, although she was never introduced as an active member of the Geological Society or didn't have time to become an actual member or board member of the Paleontographical Society, she was still recognized as a very important contributor in many informal ways. But we know that her influence was real. Yeah. So if it is someone else, then there's a bigger gap than we imagine in the history that we know, and that is definitely worth investigating.
Well, it's been really fascinating talking to you about the Paleontographical Society and getting a real sense of its importance in history and its legacy. Of course, it does continue today, but it has this amazing history behind it. Was there anything else that you would like to bring up before we wrap up?
Well, I mean, maybe one other thing that I find particularly interesting, and if I may just comment on why there has been so little written about the Paleontographical Society. And why I think I would, launch a call really for more research to be carried on the Paleontographical Society and its history. It's also because another fascinating aspect of that time around the 1840s is the fact that at this time there was a lot of endeavors dedicated to uncovering and promoting the historical heritage of a nation, right? In the case of France, we can see it with the creation of actual historical committees that are dedicated to gathering information about all the various monuments that exist on the French territory, and then creating illustrations and descriptions of it. And we see the same thing happening in Great Britain as well, with various groups like the British Archaeological Society, was founded in 1843. And its goals are pretty much similar to the ones that the Paleontological Society are setting for themselves, which is to describe as accurately as possible and illustrate the historical heritage of the nation, right? So there is also an interesting, I would say, line of questioning here, because the Paleontological Society is not just about the history of paleontology, the history of visualization in paleontology, but also the history of the creation of the notion of geoheritage, right? Oh, and okay. The idea that there is such a thing as a geoheritage, which is very interesting and fascinating concept to me, because how did we create that sense that the national past, right, the past of a nation, could somehow be linked to the geological past? And so that's a very fascinating avenue of research, because it is not an obvious idea that, and in many ways it's a problematic idea, although we understand its importance, right, for the defense and so for securing a lot of specimens and a lot of landscape. It's still a very problematic idea. So going back to tracing back its history and how this connection between the national past and the geological past has been created, I think we'll end up studying the Paleontological Society, because the first order of mission that they included when they founded the society was to describe not just fossils, but the fossils of Great Britain.
Yes, and it's still the remit very much, yeah.
So I would say this is another argument, right, to continue discussing, to further really the research on the history of the Paleontological Society, which is mm-hmm. so drastically undervalued. And I think for its 175th birthday, deserves much more.
Well, I would have to agree. Well, that's a really great way to end. I mean, basically with a call for future research. And certainly I'm sure the Society would be delighted to hear from people who would be interested in carrying out that research, in supporting them for exploring this or any other theme that comes up from our discussion or from people's researches. Well, thank you again so much. It's been really fascinating chatting with you and hearing about the wider context of the formation of the Society. Thank you for being on Paleocast.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.